Our old buddy Chris Gebhardt from NASASpaceflight.com is on the phone with us. Good morning, Chris. How are you?
Morning. I'm doing good. How about yourself?
Good. It's good to talk to you. It's been a while. There have been some pretty cool things going on with NASA and with SpaceX. The Dragon, which is the new ship that they are planning to finally get our astronauts back to the International Space Station with, right? Give me the background, Chris, but basically since we stopped flying space shuttles, we've had to rely on the Russian Soyuz capsules to get any of our astronauts up to the International Space Station. It's been quite a while now. This is our first hope to finally have our own spacecraft again to take our astronauts back and forth. Is that right?
It is. It is, and it's not just for our own astronauts from NASA, but it's also going to be ferrying up crew members from Canada, Europe, Japan, and even Russia as well. So it's a huge step forward for NASA and for the International Space Station program, but more so it's the first commercially built and privately built human-rated spacecraft. And it was a pretty spectacular test flight that they did this past week from the launch last Saturday to the splashdown in the Atlantic yesterday morning.
And this was a test flight, so this didn't have any humans on board. This was a spacecraft with, like, basically crash test dummy with all sorts of sensors. Took off. Did it dock with the space station and everything and then undock and come back?
Yeah, so exactly right. So it didn't carry any humans on board, even though it was capable of doing so. So basically, NASA and SpaceX treated this Crew Dragon test flight as if it had people on it. It was a complete practice run from everything from the pre-launch timeline to liftoff all the way through docking and then return yesterday. So, so when they launched last Saturday morning, they got to the International Space Station on Sunday, and Dragon docked to the space station. It was the first time that an American spacecraft had docked to the International Space Station since the retirement of the shuttle in 2011. The two American resupply craft that we have, one from SpaceX and one from Northrop Grumman, actually fly up to the station and then have to be grabbed by the station's robotic arm and berthed to the station. So this was the first docking of an American craft in almost 8 years, and that docking went perfectly. Dragon docked right on time last Sunday, and everything with the flight just seems to go absolutely perfect. There were no major issues that came up during the flight. The only big thing that happened, which isn't really even a big thing, it was just sort of we need to adjust that later on, was that the temperature inside Dragon's crew caps, the crew module, was just a little higher than what they had expected pre-flight before they got to the space station. And that's a relatively easy adjustment of the environmental support system. So all the years, and I mean, we do mean years for this, because the initiation of the commercial crew program, as it's called, stretches back to the first, stretches back before the retirement of the space shuttle in 2011 and to the first administration for President Obama. And to an extent to President Bush as well. And, you know, the years and nearly decade of extreme hard work from SpaceX and NASA really paid off in a spectacular flight. And it led NASA yesterday, an organization that's usually very, very cautious about what they say as something is happening or shortly after a flight event occurs. But about 45 minutes after the capsule splashed down yesterday, NASA's deputy program manager for commercial crew was on NASA television talking about how Dragon performed better than NASA expected it to, and that they had seen nothing in the data, although they still have a lot of reviews to do. They saw nothing that would preclude the first crew test flight from taking place later this year with Crew Dragon. And that's an amazing statement and testament from NASA for just how successful this test flight was.
Tell me a little bit about SpaceX. So it's Elon Musk's company. Is it privately held? Is it publicly held?
It's a privately held company. So You can't find it on the stock exchange or anything like that. And it was, you know, in 2010 when they launched their first Falcon 9. So and that's another way, a good way to think about this. A year before, less than a year before the space shuttle program ended, SpaceX launched the very first Falcon 9, and 8 years later, they started launching a crew-capable vehicle. That is an amazing achievement for a private company that was the new kid on the block 8-9 years ago, and was really a private company with this huge ambition of changing the launch market, which they have. But that when they started in 2010, really with the Falcon 9, they were dismissed by a lot of people in the rocket industry as, oh, you're cute, you have ideas, you know, reality will, you know, you'll learn the reality of the business. And they ended up teaching everyone else who'd been there for quite a few years and decades what the new reality of the business was. And we see a lot of companies moving toward the exact same things that SpaceX said they wanted to do 9 years ago, that a lot of people said, nah, that'll never happen. And now we see a lot of companies moving toward that, like reusability and lower cost for rocketry. So, you know, this little private held company 9 years ago, I mean, if you've told me then that we'd be, you know, here this morning talking about them having launched a successful crew mission to the station and having almost 70 missions of their rocket under their belt in just 8 years, I probably would have said, I'll believe it when I see it.
Yeah.
And I do believe it when I see it, because here we are.
Yeah, no kidding. And do you know, is the company profitable? Is it hoping to be someday, or where are they at as far as the money, and how well is this going to keep working?
Yeah, so even though it's a private company, Elon Musk and Gwynne Shotwell, the chief operating officer and president of SpaceX, have talked a little bit about the company's finances. And from the little that we do know, they are profitable, and they have been for a few years now. And they're hoping that profitability will increase dramatically, actually starting this year and actually starting next month. Because part of what SpaceX is doing is they're not just a commercial satellite launch company or a crew launch services provider for NASA now. Those are certainly two of their biggest areas and their biggest contracts. But, you know, this is also the organization that's building the major and huge Starship. It's that big stainless steel thing that you see being built a little bit in Texas right now. And this is the ship that's going to be able to carry up to 100 people at a time back and forth from Mars. And the goal is that those flights will start sometime in the next decade, sometime in the 2020s. And of course, that's a huge undertaking. And one of the ways that they're looking to stay profitable and stay in the game is through an internet-based satellite network called Starlink, which will be able to provide just as fast or faster internet and broadband service that you're used to at your home or work. But instead of it being fed through wires and through a ground network, it will be beamed down from space. And we're talking about a 12,000 satellite constellation. And that's, I didn't misspeak. You heard that right. They're talking about, over the course of a few years, launching 12,000 of these tiny little satellites into Earth orbit to create this global internet satellite network, so that you could take your little internet receiver anywhere with you on the face of the planet and receive and stay connected anywhere. And what they're thinking is that there's a huge demand and a huge need for this, not just from a private perspective, but from a company and a corporate perspective as well. And that's really what they're looking at in terms of staying profitable and really staying in the game and helping to change even more of the nature of what we use space for, as they continue to look forward to establishing human colonies on Mars.
Well, that sounds all very aggressive and interesting. So 12,000 satellites, how big are these satellites?
Yeah, so they're not that big, actually. They're talking about launching, I believe it's up to 100 of them at a time on the Falcon 9 rocket, and the first batch of these Starlink satellites are currently set to launch next month in April here from Florida. But they're not that big. They're big enough, and they have trackers and transponders on so that the military and Space Command can track them successfully. Because one of the things when you launch very small things into orbit that becomes a problem is being able to track them, because we need to make sure that our satellites that are up there or our rockets that are launching and especially the International Space Station and any vehicle that carries crew won't accidentally run into them. And, you know, we've had a couple of satellite collisions in the past. And you don't want to get into a situation where you can't track them. So they're big enough to be tracked. And they're really cool little compact pieces of engineering. They actually launched two test Starlink satellites last year in 2018 in February from a launch out in Vandenberg, just to make sure that everything worked and that the ground receiving stations could communicate with them. And everything has marched forward on that, and it looks like definitely from filings that they've done with the Federal Communications Commission and the FAA to get launch licenses approved, that they're ready to start launching that next month.
So that's one way they plan on making money, is by doing that, and that's going to help support everything else. One thing that I was reading in one of the articles that I have here is that, you know, with this these missions to the International Space Station, they could also possibly sell tickets to, you know, actual just citizens who wanted to pay. How do they work that out, or have they worked that out with the International Space Station? If they want to do space tourism, will that be part of their deal? Say, we'll fly these people for this cost, but then once in a while we're going to sneak somebody on here who's going to get to stay at the space station for a bit?
Yeah, and that's a great question, because it is part of the commercial crew contracts that both SpaceX and Boeing, who is building the other crew capsule for human transportation to the International Space Station, that one's called Starliner, that any leftover seats after the ISS crew assignments are given, and we expect Dragon and Starliner to be launching about four people at a time up to the station and then bringing them back. Any leftover seats, and Dragon can carry up to seven people, so those three extra seats could be sold to space tourists. And it's not a new thing. Russia has done this before. Russia oftentimes sells leftover seats on the Soyuz when one of those three seats isn't being used to a space tourist, and they go. And the way it works on Russia is they go up on one Soyuz with a crew for the space station. They spend about a week or so on the station, and then they come back with another two-person subset of the International Space Station crew. So they're both launching and landing on a Soyuz within about a week of each other. The interesting thing with how commercial crew is going to work, or exactly how it's going to work, that we're still waiting to see, is even if SpaceX and Boeing have the right to sell those seats, the way we're thinking it's going to work is that, let's say in March right now, a Dragon would launch a crew up to the space station. And then that would be followed 6 months later with a Starliner vehicle being launched. So exactly how those spaceflight participants would come back and how quickly they'd be staying on the International Space Station is still something that NASA and those providers are trying to work out. And it's worth noting, too, that before SpaceX, before Dragon and Boeing with Starliner, NASA had a very firm policy ever since 1986 and the loss of the Challenger that no regular civilian would fly on a NASA-funded mission, and no civilian would fly up to the International Space Station on a U.S. rocket. And they obviously got very nervous about that after losing Kristen McAuliffe as one of the seven members of the Challenger crew. So this is also for NASA to agree that SpaceX and Boeing have the right to do this is a huge step forward in NASA's cultural thinking as well, and really goes towards something that some NASA higher-ups, specifically Bill Gerstenmaier, who is basically the head of NASA's Human Exploration Department at NASA, said in a press conference last week before this Crew Dragon test flight took off that one of the things that has been really beneficial to NASA with this partnership with SpaceX is that SpaceX has really forced NASA to look at things differently and approach certain elements of space flight from a different perspective than what the agency had been used to for several decades. And we're seeing that not just with the design of the crew vehicles and what they're going to be doing for NASA with NASA purchasing rides instead of building the rockets themselves, but also with this, you know, agreement that, yeah, maybe it is time to open up the International Space Station to American tourists who can afford that, you know, 50 some odd million dollar price tag for a seat on a Dragon or a Starliner.
Well, and do we know what kind of training they would put them through? I imagine Kristen McAuliffe went through a ton of real hardcore astronaut training with space tourists. Would it be simple enough that, you know, pretty much anybody would be able to go, or would they have to pass pretty rigorous tests?
So they'd still have to pass pretty rigorous medical testing, just because you don't want to get into a situation where you're letting someone with an underlying condition that could cause a very serious medical condition due to the stresses of space flight. You wouldn't want to permit someone like that to launch, because you'd still want to protect them as much as possible. But in terms of the training for actual flight, the Dragon is also unique in that it is the first completely automated U.S. human-carrying space vehicle. So, you know, the Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo spacecrafts, while they flew uncrewed test missions, were really designed to be, you know, hands-on pilot vehicles for what the crews needed to do once they were in orbit. And of course, the space shuttle could not be flown without a human on board. And the Dragon can, as we just saw it do. The Dragon is basically, you know, you guys were talking a little bit before I came on about this idea of, you know, like a self-driving car could come pick you up and, you know, you could sleep both ways, right, to and from
right.
work.
Yeah.
And you know, so could occur on Dragon. Dragon and Starliner are designed to be completely hands-off and execute the whole thing automatically. So in that regard, participating or paying spaceflight tourists wouldn't receive a lot of training on what to do in terms of actually flying Dragon. They would most likely just receive the basic, like, here's what to do in an emergency, you know, type situation. And then the same would be true for the International Space Station. You know, even if you go back to the early 1980s when, you know, quote unquote, regular civilians were flying on space shuttle missions, they did not receive full training. They were basically a hands-off, don't touch anything unless there's an emergency. And NASA would probably take a very similar approach just because of the sensitive nature of the experiments and the systems on the station. But they'd receive some training in what to do in cases of emergency.
Chris,
definitely.
I'm out of time here because we got to get to the news at the top of the hour. But it's been fascinating to hear about. We'll check in with you again soon, okay?
Sounds good. Anytime, Matt.
Sounds great. Chris Gebhardt from NASASpaceflight.com. You can read more there. We've got news coming up with Orion. No, we've got the show coming up with Orion and news with Roger from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom here in a minute on 720 WGN.